Podcast, and I'm your host, Phil Coover. The Real Estate for Breakfast Podcast is a Chicago-centric commercial real estate podcast utilizing finance and real estate professionals and attorneys to create thoughtful commentary on current real estate issues, helpful descriptions of common legal and business issues, and entertaining discussion. This podcast is a mixture of real estate, business, and law. A few house cleaning items before we get to our featured guest today. Just want to let the listeners know that we're going to slow this podcast down a little bit, and we're going to produce them once every 2 weeks. So we're going to do it on a bi-weekly basis. Look for it on Tuesdays of each week, and we will start moving forward on this bi-weekly basis going forward. If you'd like to reach us, you can reach us by emailing us at solutioncenter@SATCLTD or by visiting our new website, realestatebreakfast.com. Please go visit the website, enjoy it. It's very sleek. We're very excited about it. And this is also a good opportunity to mention and to thank our sponsor, SATC Solution Center, L3C, which is the Education and Development Division of the law firm Schenck Annis Tepper Campbell. I'm an attorney and principal with that firm. Today on our show, we have Colin Leitner, and Colin is the general counsel of Dieter Investments, LLC, and wanted to have him on the podcast for three reasons. First of all, he was in town, so we had to grab him while he was in town. But he works out of Austin, Texas, which the investment company is based out of, and he's become the general counsel at a very early age. Became general counsel of this company by the time he was 30, and I think the story of how he got this position is just a fantastic story. It's the closest thing I can think of to the way Bud Fox got to meet Gordon Gekko that I've actually seen play out in the real world. So I hope you enjoy that when you hear old people talk about the definition of the word moxie, say that kid's got moxie. Well, this kid has moxie. I also wanted to have him on the podcast because he and his company were recently sued because of one of their investments. Now, Colin is, as I mentioned, based out of Austin, Texas, and this is a Chicago-centric commercial real estate podcast, but Colin did go to law school here, which is how I met him, and he's a very good friend and a confidant of mine. And it was interesting because he was in town just visiting, and one of his company's interests is called Nook, and it's on 6th Street in Austin, Texas, and it was sued just 2 days before we taped this on December 30th, 2016 by the Westin. And what's interesting about this case is it could happen really to a lot of different people in real estate because they were sued for private nuisance. And I certainly, when I started this podcast, did not think I would spend my fourth episode talking about private nuisance action. But private nuisance is a civil lawsuit. So there's a difference between criminal lawsuits and civil lawsuits. So here this is about noise violations, and the criminal statute would be if you call the police and you say, hey, there's someone being too loud. That's criminal. But here's a civil case, and where one party complains that the other party is causing unreasonable, unwarranted, or unlawful use of one's property in a manner that substantially interferes with the enjoyment or use of your property without an actual trespass or physical invasion. So if somebody had started a meth lab right next door to you, the odors and that were emanating on your property could be considered a private nuisance. But there's a defense to this case, and that's if you come to the nuisance. So if you build a house next to a garbage dump, you can't later complain about the smell. So what happened here, and Colin will get into the weeds and the details of it, but this little bar called The Nook in Austin 6th Street, which is like, think Bourbon Street in New Orleans or downtown Nashville. It's a lot of live music. It's been there for years, and the Westin built a hotel right next to it. And now the Westin is complaining that the Nook is causing too much noise, which is deterring and annoying and hindering its guests, which is damaging the value of the Westin's property. So it's a very interesting dispute. There's been a lot of press over it in the Austin area. I think that a lot of the local bars and restaurants are watching it very closely because they don't want to be squeezed out of this area of downtown Austin, which has been such a vibrant and vital part of the community and the community's nightlife for so many years, so that if the Weston lawsuit sets precedent that they can do this and cause the restaurants and bars to tone the music down, it's going to have an impact on the entire Austin community. So we had to grab Colin while he was here, and because he's willing to talk about that. And then finally, we had him on just to talk about, he's recently been pitching. He's part of also a part owner in a commercial development company, which he'll talk about. And they've recently been trying to attract foreign dollars. And I thought that his story about trying to pitch his project to foreign investments was a very interesting and unusual thing that's occurring. So please sit back and enjoy our conversation with Colin Leitner. Thank you. Today with Colin Leitner. Colin is a principal at Leitner & Associates. It's a private firm, but he is also the general counsel of Dieter Investments, and Colin is a principal with Metis Capital. Is that how you pronounce it?
It's Metis Capital, but that's pretty good. It's Greek. Who knows how you say it?
Right. I'm very pleased to have Colin in the office today. Colin, as I just mentioned, he's a real estate developer. He's a general counsel of an investing company, and he's runs his own private shop. And you were the general manager of a Mazda dealership for 2 years.
Almost general manager. Executive manager is the title, and the important distinction there is I don't know that much about cars. I really just handled the business end.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And then. So, Colin, that is quite a resume for somebody who's only in their mid-30s. We won't say the exact number, but...
Thanks, Bill.
But I'd like to back up a little bit. I'd like to start with how you got here, and then we can talk about what you're working on today, just because I personally think it's an interesting story. You went to Cranbrook High School, which is...
We're going all the way back.
Yeah, we're going all the way back. But Cranbrook is notable because if anybody has never seen Cranbrook, it is in... the suburbs of Detroit, and it is a gorgeous school. It is nicer than 99% of universities, and it's worth Googling just to
it look is. At it's gorgeous. It's pretty amazing. It was an amazing place to grow up and get to explore. I guess I'll just give the quick background on me. I grew up in southeastern Michigan. I had the privilege of going to Cranbrook Kingswood, which is a prep school there. With a big, beautiful campus, and more importantly than that, really, really brilliant, dedicated staff and faculty. Prepare me, they did. College was great, of course, but it was kind of a breeze once I got there and enjoyable, and went immediately on to law school here in Chicago at DePaul.
I would say your most important part was that first day when you met me.
Probably.
That was probably the critical component to your success.
I wouldn't be here had that not happened.
That is true. That is very accurate.
I kind of whizzed through college and law school there. I guess the highlights... the highlights are that I got degrees in economics and psychology in undergrad. And then after getting the JD at DePaul, had an opportunity and took it to go back and get a little bit of graduate tax work at DePaul's MBA school, Kelstat. And that really helped me. That's something that I really encourage people to do. It's not too late if you need to learn something really anytime. Go figure it out.
That's a good. You're never too late to learn more.
Exactly.
And then, so right out of law school, tell us about what you first did, because it's different. I'm sure you use those skills, but it's different than what you're doing now.
Yeah, so right out of law school, I was kept on a litigation firm and quickly moved over to a small tax boutique firm. And in that firm, I did a lot of different things, but the vast majority was tax controversy work. And for those of you not familiar with tax controversy, it's just... anything from audit to litigation in the various different jurisdictions and venues that can take place. Most tax controversy work never sees the light of day. It's in audit, and it gets closed down. Maybe it goes to appeals. Nobody ever really sees it. But I got to do a lot of tax litigation in tax court, federal court, and courts of appeals around the country, as well as just a ton of audits and at pretty interesting transactions, not your normal hobby loss issues, complex international transactions. Took me down to Brazil a couple times.
Oh, that's right.
All around the continental United States for, I think I did about 80 IRS summons interviews, which are the IRS equivalent of depositions. And so I got a very quick learning experience there, kind of thrown into the fire and learned a ton.
Very nice. Seriously, I forgot you had gone to Brazil for that work. You know, I had a couple of cases out in Kane County recently.
So oh, yeah.
That's pretty similar.
I hear the foliage is beautiful this time of year.
It is. Well, hey, I'm from DeKalb, so I love it. But so you're doing tax law, and then in Chicago, but you went to Austin, Texas. And I would love it. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'd love you to tell the story of how you got to Austin, Texas, because it's the closest story I've ever heard of Bud Fox getting in touch with Gordon Gekko. There must be a definition. Picture you next to the definition of persistence in the dictionary, kid.
I like that that allegory. Let's hope that the end of that movie doesn't end up the same for me.
Right.
So I was working at this small tax boutique here in Chicago in the Loop. And like I said, most of my work was tax controversy and actually quite a bit of corporate finance work as well. And so we had, at this small firm, we probably had only about 100 clients in total. And about half of those were, I was kind of in charge of their files. I was the top associate and billing a lot. But when you have corporate finance work and a lot of tax controversy work, your clients tend to be, for the most part, older, richer, white men. There's no political comment there. That's just how it tends to happen. And I had one client who was not that. He was a younger guy. He was pretty much my age. We became friends. And I had a couple of my biggest professional wins at an early part in my career for him, and it's pretty powerful when you can call a client and give them news the day before their birthday that significantly impacts their life and has a bunch of zeros attached to it. Can't really get too much more into it than that, but I think I did very good work for him and probably got a little lucky along the way. And I was looking to make a change, and I was looking at some of the more traditional options. I had a lot of tax work, so I was looking at maybe going to one of the big four and consulting firms and doing tax, or a bigger firm in town that needed that kind of practice built out. And I just, there was something tugging at me. I've always been a little bit more entrepreneurial. And while I really enjoy the legal side of things, I just couldn't ignore that part of me. So
right. I mean, I think when I first met you, you said you wanted to be a real estate developer.
I was the only person
in law school that was saying that.
I don't doubt that at all. Everybody wanted to be in court or do transactions or lock up bad guys or protect people who couldn't protect themselves. Those are pretty much the four categories, right?
Right.
I think I was just focused on it, something that my family's done on a small scale, and I really like it. So I bought a ticket, and I flew down with really not much notice to my client. His name is Misha Dieter, and like I said, he was my age. At the time, I think we were both in our 20s or maybe... maybe he had just turned 30.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And I flew down, let him know I was coming, but there wasn't a whole lot of warning, and I didn't tell him why I was coming.
Right.
And I had a talk with them, and I said, you know, look, I'm between you and me, I'm going to make a change. I don't know when, but I'm going to make a change. And you've got a lot of files with us for your small business. I've got them all in good order, but you know, you're going to need more than just one person to hand these off to. If I leave, you need to be prepared for that. Or you could just hire me right now.
Right, right. And I love that story because you're sitting here, you're a young attorney, still have law school loans, and you're looking for options, and you just made it happen. You just said, I'm going to buy a ticket to Austin. I'm going to email this guy and tell him I'm coming. He probably thinks I'm delivering some bad news about a tax case. And you just go down there, and you just pitch him and say, look, you're paying all of this for my services at this firm. Why don't you just have me full time?
Yeah, you know, I never thought about the fact of what he may have thought about me coming down with no news.
Horrible news coming.
It wasn't bad news, obviously. It was good news. And he didn't immediately give me the job. He made me wait about 3 hours. He
said, right. I didn't know that.
He said, well, you've given me a lot to think about. I need to discuss with my partner. And I thought I'd have to wait a couple weeks. And he said, well, let's have dinner tonight. And so I went back to my hotel and kind of mulling over what I had done and knowing that I was going to leave, you know, my current position regardless, but really hoping that this was going to turn into something and be the door into the business side instead of just firm life. He called me a couple hours after and said, congratulations, you got the job. Let's go have a drink.
Awesome.
We went downtown, had some lamb chops and a couple beers, and he showed me Austin, Texas.
Fantastic. And now you guys own your company, Dieter Investments, that you work for, owns several of the bars and restaurants on 6th Street.
We do have a couple. 6th Street, for those of you who are not familiar with Austin, Texas, is kind of the main nightlife strip down there, and there's more than one now. But historically, East 6th Street is a where live music happens. It's the
right.
protected historic entertainment district, and it's where, you know, all the greats have played.
Yeah. There's Nashville, there's Bourbon Street, New Orleans, and there's 6th Street.
And there's 6th Street, yeah. So we, since I've come to work for Dieter Investments and their position as general counsel, you know, we've partnered with a couple operators and got a couple different projects there that are going well. They're also fun projects. They're pretty small for us, so there's a little bit of labor of love aspect, pride of ownership type things going on, but they're both good investments and we enjoy them. We do have some kind of interesting news on one of them. One of them is called the Nook Amphitheater, and it's a small, as you can tell by the name, a little oxymoron there. It is built like a small amphitheater. It is an open-air venue for live music right in the thick of the district I've described. And it's only about 3,000 square feet. We're not talking anything fancy. Nothing down in this place is fancy. It's a lot of shotgun bars, lots of good live music. If you're looking for, you know, leather seats and cocktails, don't go there.
Right.
But if you're looking for some great live music, really fun experience, and something that you can't really get anywhere else other than maybe those other two places in America that you named earlier, Phil, you know, that's the place to go in Austin. So the Nook Amphitheater has been there since March 2012, and we have a pretty good following, local following, and we even fly in some acts from time to time. We were recently sued, so we are in litigation, so I have to be a little careful about what we discuss here, but we were recently sued by the Westin Hotel that was built 20 feet behind us. And was erected in 2014 and 15 for private nuisance for the music
really?
That we play.
Private nuisance. So they're saying that your live music facility has too much live music, even though they built the Westin right next to it.
That's exactly correct. So without getting too far into the weeds about the cause of action of private nuisance, anybody can kind of look that up. And if they feel like doing a deep dive.
Everyone's looking it up
right now. They're on their iPads. The backstory here, and it's being reported all over the news down there. If you look it up, it's on our website.
We should mention we're taping this on December 30th. Colin's in town in Chicago, but by the time this airs, there may be more developments.
There will assuredly be more developments. The news cycle here is fast. In the last 48 hours, I believe there have been at least 10 TV stories on this. There's at least 12 articles online at the moment, and I know there's a couple more coming from the Statesman. Austin American Statesman is the big paper down there. The Austin Chronicle is the other big paper down there locally. I just responded to a call and an email from Spectrum, which is Time Warner Cable, for those of you who haven't gotten the change of billing there. But the stories range about who's more sympathetic, but the basic premise here is big corporate interest moves into the live music capital of the world, into a protected historic music district,
sure,
and then tries to shut down music. Now, I am aware, even though I have my biases, that nothing's quite as simple as that. But it's becoming a pretty interesting story, and we have a lot of support, which we're very thankful for. We'll see how it plays out. I'm really hoping for an agreed resolution. We've done a lot of work over the last year with the Westin and their two previous attorneys who were pretty good to work with to try to find a mutually agreeable solution, and I thought we had found one. We made a pretty cut and dry proposal to them. There's a speaker system that was developed in Europe, and Europeans always seem to be a little bit more ahead than American businesses and technology on these issues, because they have more densely populated areas and older, more historic construction. But the system, it's called a JBN system, and it essentially, without getting into all the sound technology, it allows for the full spectrum of high and low frequency sound, which is, you know, tweeters to subwoofers. And having that full feel while not projecting those low frequencies out toward other places, in this case the West. And it plays top down as opposed to left right, or right left as the case may be. And low frequency sound is very difficult to control, and this system does a very good job of controlling it, so that we worked with them to demo the system, to bring it over and demo it in front of City Hall. And I personally let counsel for the Westin know that demo was happening, and suggested that he and his client go over there and take a look, which they did. While I didn't get any direct feedback from them, I the system works. It works well.
Right.
And it works so well that the manufacturer, JBN, issued us a letter of guarantee saying that the low frequency decibel levels, they guarantee a 10 decibel reduction. Now, I did not know this until I've learned a little bit about this recently, but 6 decibel reduction is a halving. That's a 50% decrease when it comes to sound. That's not, you know, that's a big, big difference. So a 10 decibel difference is about a 70 or 80% difference. When, you know, you're talking from 100 to 20 or 30, if you're thinking about this in just percentage terms. So there's almost no chance that this system won't work for both us and the Westin. And my proposal to the Westin is, you know, you're complaining about your property rights. We are well within the law. we are in a protected district, and we're not. If we were breaking the law, you could lodge complaints, and the city would do something about it, and they haven't.
Right. Right.
So why don't you spend $75,000 to install the system in our space, and everybody's happy? Their petition claims $1 million worth of damages.
It sounds to me like they built a home next to the ocean, or complaining about the moisture getting into the building.
I agree with you, Phil. I'm sure counsel for the Westin wouldn't.
Right.
But the other issue here is, you know, we pre-build the pre-engineering. They had sound engineers measuring sound behind our venue before construction started, you know, years ago, and our owner saw them and said, "Come on in, stay later. It gets louder. We want you to build the spec."
Right.
And there are other hotels. You know, Austin's been growing like leaps and bounds. There are other hotels that have gone up in the same district or other districts that play just as loud music, also within the legal limit. And they don't have the problems that the Westin has. Now, I don't know exactly what decisions were made by that developer that they're apparently very much impacted by our sound, even though it's at that legal limit. But it sounds to me like there may have been some decisions that they wish they could have back.
Right. I mean, it is interesting to bring this back around to more of a real estate topic, is that when you're developing something, you're building something, one of the things is you have to take into consideration is not just the parcel that you're buying, but what's going on around you, what might impact your customers, your clients, your invitees, and how can you build what you want to build to protect your customers or to make it for a better experience for the people that you want on your parcel of property.
100%. And that's kind of where I was going. I was kind of wrapping up my spiel on our controversy with the Westin, but point being, I see both sides of this. I'm certainly biased toward our venue, though I do think we are on the side of right here, both regard to the law as well as the court of public opinion. Austin culture.
I'm sure, you know, it sets a lot of precedent. If somebody can come in there, build a building, and then sue an existing venue, I'm sure everyone on 6th Street has great interest in what's going on here.
I won't get into it too much because we do have this controversy and some things developing, but to say that there's been a lot of public support on our side is really a massive understatement. And there's some groundswell of some business support here as well. And again, by the time this airs, there will be a lot more news on this if anybody cares to Google it. But leading it more into the developer side, you're exactly right, Phil. I have sympathy for the Westin. The decision that was almost undoubtedly made about, you know, what spec to build, their sound deadening too. That's the type of decision that I face every day with my own development, and they aren't easy. It's not a binary decision, even though it feels like it, because each one impacts a whole chain of events and decisions down the line. Each little wrinkle that you make is kind of the butterfly that flaps its wings.
Right.
You have just a cascading effect with regard to your pro formas, your returns, the interest costs, your timetables, all the deliverables that you have to get done, now contractors and subcontractors aren't going to hold the number that they quoted you. Their timetables have now gone out the window if you make a change late in the game. And it's very difficult to stop that inertia. And so when you, especially on a big project, and I've certainly never developed anything even close to the size of the Westin's hotel, even on a project one-tenth that size, there's a million decisions to make, and they all matter. So I do have sympathy for them there. I think they're very, very wrong in their stance, and I think they will lose, and they are already losing quite badly on the court of public opinion. Which matters a lot in Austin.
Right.
As anyone who's been following Uber and Lyft saga in Austin will know, It doesn't pay to be big, bad corporate interests coming into Austin trying to push the little guys around.
Well, thanks for sharing that story with us and letting us know about what's going on 6th Street. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your real estate developments, because I'll tell you my perspective about Dieter Investments, and you tell me if I'm right or wrong. But I envision Dieter Investments as an investment company, and my impression is that it started more as trading stocks, derivatives, futures, and now you guys are really interested in investments that make money of all sorts, as long as it's something that you feel that you can learn, and you guys take big swings, and that's sort of your big picture strategy. How am I doing?
That's correct. None of what you said is wrong, but I'll add a little color. Dieter Investments is founded by Misha, who I mentioned earlier, my principal, and he is a brilliant securities trader. There's no other words for it. He could have his pick of hedge funds if someone if he felt like taking money from other people. He refuses. We really operate more like a family office. All of the trading is in-house, and trading has always been and will always be Dieter Investments' primary business. It will always dwarf all our other projects combined. Okay. That said, you're right. We do take big swings, and we like other businesses, and so we've got a couple bars and restaurants. We recently were the general partner and I'm not sure if we're the largest, I'm trying to remember, one of the largest shareholders in a fairly big nightlife concept down in South Beach called Aura. Just opened for Art Basel earlier this month.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. We're very happy to get it open. Miami Beach development is a development of a whole nother kind.
Yeah, I'm sure that wouldn't be its own podcast, just trying to talk about how to get an enterprise up and running on Miami Beach.
It is. It's always harder when you're trying to do something remote. So that was a challenge for us. But we had really good partners and really good management there to get across the goal line, though it was not without not without its challenges. Dieter Investments has a bunch of other projects, and our probably biggest non-trading project right now is Metis Capital, which you mentioned at the outset. And Metis Capital is the development in which I'm a partner and I manage day-to-day operations of. For all intents and purposes, Metis Capital is my development company, backed by Dieter Investments. So that's my baby, and that's what I really love to spend the majority of my time on.
Well, that's fantastic. It's interesting because a lot of people get into commercial real estate because they have connections right out of college and they learn the business and then they look for opportunities and then they're looking for capital. You kind of came about it from a different perspective. You were working for a company that had capital and you're just looking for opportunities. And it's a nice way to enter the market. But what did you find? So it's your development company. What was your first project?
So Metis Capital, at least thus far, really only develops one type of product, real estate product, and that's commercial condominiums.
Okay.
Commercial condos are not that typical. They in the United States, you'll find the vast majority of them on the West Coast, particularly Southern California. And for those of you listening out there, you may never even heard of a commercial condominium. But for legal purposes and development purposes, they're very similar to a residential condo. You got to have your bylaws. You got to have your condo regime documents. Like they teach you in law school. Think of a condo like you own a box of air inside the four walls.
Sure.
That's the same thing, except instead of living there, you operate a business out of it. It could be office space. Ours is mostly office space. But we are in the flex area of real estate, so there's a little bit of a light industrial element to some of it. Our users are typically We've got some contractors, subcontractors, electrical engineers, a couple tech companies, one software company, one hardware company, a company that is developing, doing R&D on drone batteries. So,
interesting.
Trying to get longer flight. They got some big government contract, and they're trying to make fuel cells that'll last forever. So Metis Capital's main project right now is in a place called Sheldon Cove, and it's named Sheldon Cove Corporate Center. And we delivered 50,000 square feet of commercial condos in late 2015, and we're 90% sold and leased.
Very nice.
As of about a month ago, and hoping to wrap that up. And we're about to break ground on our second building, which will be an additional 50,000 square feet. We're working quite a few bigger deals as we see more institutional money and foreign money get interested in our project.
So what is attractive to these tenants and to these investors about the commercial condominium and flex space in general?
So flex space is stands for flexible, and it essentially means it's somewhere between office and light industrial and warehouse space. So if you can imagine a spectrum of real estate product, it can fall anywhere between those two. So ours is very office heavy flex space. It's a very nice building. It's purposefully built to a higher quality and a higher grade than most flex buildings would be. A lot more glass, a lot more natural light, and the interior finish outs mirror that. A lot of space that feels more like the office we're sitting in now than it would ever feel like a light industrial space, but that business owner may have a small warehouse out there, may store materials for whatever business that he has out there.
Sure.
So we have, so that's kind of the type of space we have, and what people like about it, I think, is the high quality. I think they also like the idea that they can own the space. We both rent them and lease them as well as sell them. And anytime you can buy an asset, especially when people have had a number of years of good business returns like we've had in this economy, that's an attractive thing for them to stop paying rent.
Sure.
So they certainly like to be able to buy them, and that's one of the reasons we did commercial condominiums, is because there's really not any of that product.
You're right.
In Austin,
it's very
or really
rare.
Anywhere.
It's very rare to come across. I think I've only come across a few in my time. So if you have commercial condos, I mean, in a residential setting, you're going to have the residents are going to elect a board that's going to manage the property. Who's managing the property? If you have 10 commercial tenants, how does the management structure work?
Well, it works virtually identically. And like a new residential building, the developer starts off as the board.
Is it as catty as the board
so
for
far
residential
it's not.
Condos in downtown Chicago?
So far it's not, and I don't expect it will be. Thus far we've had a really great group of buyers and tenants, and then as the landlord for all of the tenants, we naturally hold a big ownership percentage in the condo association. So we do have co-owners. Obviously people buy. But I really make a point early on in the process, in the sales process even, to note that we both sell and lease, and that for the life of this project, I'm probably going to be the biggest owner by percentage in the condo association because we're going to be leasing.
Right.
And so we make a point to let people know that and to become friends with the co-owners, because it's really it's a community. Part of the value that we're selling is the community of businesses that join. So far that's been a really great thing. I've noticed a couple businesses that have come into the park have started doing business together, and they hadn't met before. So MEP contractor, that's mechanical engineering and plumbing, he does a lot of work for the Samsung factories down there. he started doing some work for another general contractor down there who was in the same building. So it's the cattiness so far is certainly not reared its ugly head, and I don't expect it to. I think it's a little different when people don't live there. People get a little protective when right. it's their living space, whereas these are all businessmen and women, and they, well, the cooler heads tend to prevail.
Sure, sure, and I'm sure that that is reassuring to them to meet you and to understand that the management structure is probably going to be in place for a good long time. They're not going to be voting a new management team every year. I'm sure that that's comforting to know. But you're right, that is an interesting way to go about it, because normally if you're a business and you want to buy your property, you're talking about a freestanding building, and then you have to maintain the building and maintain the common areas, and now you're taking on a lot of other obligations. But if you wanted the financial approach to own your unit, but you didn't want, and you just wanted to focus on your business and not have to focus on hiring landscapers and taking care of the parking lots and doing that sort of thing, it's a great mix. It's a great hybrid.
It's a great option for a lot of people. And then also, you know, there's a price point, an entry price point that is a lot more accessible than trying to go out, find a piece of land, develop it, or find an old building that you have to retrofit and redevelop it for your purpose. This is, you know, a customizable, fully customized office or flex space for their business. They get exactly what they want. Like you said, they can focus on what's important. They still have that investment and ownership. And they don't have to be, worried about what's happening to the roof, to the four walls, to the elevator, to the landscaping. And they certainly don't have to worry about having nearly as much insurance. You know, all that's taken care of, and you get preferred pricing and management when you buy in bulk as a condo association than if you try to do it as a standalone guy with a small business on a piece of land.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that. So what are you seeing from a macro perspective, just upcoming challenges? You're seeing more foreign investment dollars come in. I think you mentioned that earlier.
Yeah, I did mention that. And I was referring to that specifically with respect to our project, but I've been seeing it in other ways too. I think anyone who's been reading financial news for the last several years has been pretty aware of China. And opinions abound about what's going on there, but there's some real obvious things that have happened there that I think everyone's watching. You know, they've had unprecedented growth for quite a few years, more new millionaires and billionaires there than anywhere else in the world, as far as I know. You know, it really works well to pump up an economy when you've had just a huge portion of the population that has been, you know, below the poverty line, and suddenly a little bit of capitalism comes in there, and now you have a brand new middle class, and you can scale with 3 billion people, pretty much any business.
Sure.
So you've got all this you know, this new wealth there, and it's finding places to go. And the safest place for all of the slings and arrows that the American economy has suffered over the last, 10 years, the U.S. dollar is still the store of value. It's still a safe haven currency. And I don't see that changing. And so it's no surprise that as the growth starts to slow in China, and as the government starts to impose more capital controls, and as people become a little worried about the fate of China, those dollars come to the United States. So
how do you get in touch with those dollars, and how do they get in touch with you?
You want all my secrets, Phil, huh?
I joke.
I went to a, all I did was I went to a summit. You know, anybody could go, the typical buy a ticket, you get a name badge, and show up at a hotel and network. It's not my favorite thing to do, forced networking is always more difficult than something, you know, having a conversation like this or meeting someone in earnest through your business and then developing that relationship, and then business tends to spring from there. But you know, sometimes it is an effective way to meet a lot of people. So I went to the Texas China Summit that was put on at the Hyatt, not the Westin, down there in Austin, Texas, and a great facility there. You know, there were...
They love live music there.
I hear they love live music at the Hyatt. Right. But without digressing too much, you know, I presented our project, and I know what, because of my background at Dieter Investments and my investment background, corporate finance background, I have what I think is a good idea of what someone as a millionaire or billionaire in China would be looking to do with at least a portion of their cash. And our project works very well for it. It is, you know, protected in a number of different ways. It cash flows. It's a great store of value.
People like cash flow.
People love cash flow. Cap rates are at historic lows. They're really paying through the nose for cash flow, and I see why. I don't think it's a bad thing right now. It's a lot of uncertainty out there, and to limit that uncertainty, you know, put it in a less risky vehicle, and then maybe that uncertainty that comes along doesn't impact you quite as much. So you know, getting their money out of Chinese yuan and into dollars first, at least some of it, is probably a good hedging mechanism and safety mechanism for them. And then putting it in real estate and then secondary productive real estate in a state and in a local economy that's well diversified and really a great local economy makes a lot of sense. So I presented our project in about 2 minutes through a translator to about 12 wealthy Chinese investors, and something stuck. So we stayed in touch, and we've had dinner, and they've come seen our project, and I was texting with a few of them over the holidays, and they'll be back in town in January or February, and they're bringing
That's great.
A few other friends. So we'll see if it works for them. And you know, my pitch to them is pretty simple. It's, you know, be my partner. You know, help me develop faster than I can on my own. I have capital to develop, but you can always save more money if you build twice as much. The economies of scale in construction are very important, with historically low interest rates, it makes sense to hold that rate for a little while and save some money on the development. So if they can let me go, you know, twice as fast or three times as fast, there's some extra returns there that I'm trying to achieve.
Sure. I love the vision of you doing this. See it as a little bit like a bake-off, where you're getting up there, you have these investors there, sitting there waiting for pitches, and just 40 people in a line coming in.
200 people in that line.
200 people. It must have been a long day for those investors. But everyone's just standing up there. You get 2 minutes. Get in there. Make your pitch. Get out.
Well, and, interestingly enough,
it's like a talent show.
It is. So, interestingly enough, you were supposed to have 15 minutes, but the pitches were... They didn't have the guy with the gong to kick people out,
you
put it that way.
You need a big cane. That's the hook on the end. You gotta pull these people off the stage.
Well, I became the guy with the cane because I was I had the ignoble position of last in line, and the investors had been there 8 hours and had listened to 200 pitches,
wow.
Many of which had gone long, and they were getting up out of their seats before I had a chance to present, and. There was
so
a general.
Freaking out.
I wasn't happy. I had spent quite a bit of yeah. time putting together what I thought was a compelling a compelling business plan that I mean, it wrote itself. I was already in the business, but I, you know, I took a long time. This was my whole day. A few days beforehand, I went and I found a translator and worked with the translator and translated our presentation into Chinese. You know, I spent a good amount of time on this, and it at least wanted my time at the plate.
Sure.
I didn't mind if I went down swinging, but I wanted to swing. So the gentleman who was presenting before me, and I use that term loosely, was not behaving himself either with regard to time or the volume of his voice. So I politely told him to kick rocks and that I was going to take two more minutes of their time. And I did that. And luckily, they sat back down and became very engaged in what I was saying to them through the translator. Also, one of the investors spoke quite good English, very good English. And she was very, very interested, and she's the one who I've been corresponding with the most.
Nice.
And then I was able to have dinner with them later that evening, and a month later they came in, had lunch, and showed them the project, and so we've been going from there. So, you know, in case you haven't seen a theme about me, you know, the story about how I got my job working for Misha is kind of similar to that. You follow the rules until you have to make a change when the rules don't work for you.
Right.
And you have to take action.
Yeah. And one of the best things about you is that you make a decision about what you think is right and you go for it. And it seems to be working for you.
I try. It doesn't mean I don't make mistakes. You know, if you prepare, and you're diligent. I'm going to say prepare again. If that's the most important, if you're prepared, and you're go after what you want in business, or whether it's a small thing or a big thing, that preparedness and that diligence and that persistence, I think that really will pay off. It certainly has for me, and I try to rededicate myself to those things almost on a daily basis. They're not something that you can learn and then forget. They're one of those lessons that I try to relearn and focus on literally every day.
I think that's a lesson worth repeating, because a lot of people think you see someone that you feel is very good on their feet, and people have told me they think I'm good on my feet in court or whatever. That's because I've prepared and I know every aspect of the case, and I've even practiced saying what I want to say to the judge or to another person in a negotiation, because if you've prepared it, it comes off so much better. I mean, there's really no other way to say it, but preparation is the most underutilized aspect in a negotiation. People just think they can go in and wing it and I'll feel my way around, and you have to prepare.
Absolutely. Shooting from the hip, it's a good skill to have, but to rely on it, that will be to your detriment. One other thing on that point that I wanted to mention is, and it kind of ties in with my career going from, you know, pure lawyer to kind of lawyer slash business person and developer, is if there's something that you can't do, or something that you maybe can do and can do very well, but you don't have the time, or it's not blending with your project, so that you can't prepare, or you can't prepare in the way you would want, farm it out.
Right.
I say that because for Metis Capital, I do a lot of work that is non-lawyerly work. I also do a lot of work that is lawyerly work. But guess what I have? I have a real estate attorney. I am a real estate
Sure.
attorney, but I have one too. And when a potential lease comes through the door, and or a potential buyer comes through the door, and they want their lawyers want a red line contract, sure, you can do that work. But if you can't get it done in 48 hours, find someone who can. Same thing with a foreclosure. Sure, you can do it, but when's the last time you did it?
Right.
If you can't do that, quickly and easily and without to the detriment to the rest of your business, find someone who can, and focus on the things that you need to focus on. If it's part of your business plan to do it yourself, make sure you allow yourself the time to do it and maybe farm out the marketing.
Sure.
But don't try to do it all.
Use that principle of comparative advantage that we all learned the first year of economics in college. Well, Colin, I think that that's a great place to end on. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks
really
for having me.
Happy to have you. Probably have you back. And really appreciate your time and you explaining how you got to be, where you are, what you're working on. And I'm looking forward to having some dinner with some friends tonight.
It was a pleasure, Phil. Thank you.
Thanks.
Shall constitute financial, investment, legal, or other professional advice. No professional relationship of any kind is created between you and the podcast host or guests. You are urged to speak with your own financial, investment, or legal advisors before making any investment or legal decisions. The opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily the opinions of the SATC Solution Center or Shank Annis Tepper Campbell or any of its employees. This podcast is created by the individual capacities of the host and guests. All opinions on this podcast are rendered based on specific facts and under certain conditions and subject to certain assumptions, and may not and should not be used or relied upon for any other purpose, including but not limited to, for use in connection with any investment purposes or legal proceedings.